Hello, this is episode number 27 of Tech Policy Weekly from the Technology Liberation Front for Thursday, August 30th, 2007. I'm your host, Adam Thier of the Progress and Freedom Foundation. On this week's show, we're going to be discussing how copyright law's first sale doctrine is evolving in the internet age and how it should be applied to a new case that's in the news right now. Joining us this week to discuss this issue are my fellow Technology Liberation Front contributors, Tim Lee of the Cato Institute. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Adam.
And Bretton Cox of the Association of Competitive Technology. Hi, Bretton.
Hey, Adam.
We're also joined this week by two very special guests, Professor Randy Picker of the University of Chicago Law School. Hello again, Professor Picker.
Hi, Adam.
And Fred Von Lohmann of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Hello again, Fred.
Hi there.
Fred, let's start with you because you are actively involved in this issue right now. In fact, the Electronic Frontier Foundation recently agreed to take a case of an eBay merchant who is facing a lawsuit from the Universal Music Group over the sale of the promotional CD. Promotional CDs, for our listeners, of course, are those free CDs that Universal and other music labels send to DJs or music reviewers to drum up publicity about their music. Now, Fred, Universal claims that those CDs are still their property even after they give them away. But I believe that you claim, or EFF claims, that Universal is trampling on copyright law's first sale doctrine by trying to restrict the sale in this case. So, Fred, start from the beginning for us and lay out some background about what first sale doctrine is all about, how it came about, that is, and how it applies in this particular case.
Sure. Let me start by telling the story. I think that'll give us a good context in which to discuss this. My client is a guy named Troy Augusto. He sells CDs, collectible merchandise, under the name Roast Beast Music on eBay. That's how he makes his living. He basically does what people have done from the dawn of the capitalist era. He buys low and he sells high. He goes to used music stores around the Los Angeles area, and with the knowledge that he has about what collectors are looking for, he picks out the collectible CDs from the bins and then posts them on eBay, where he hopes he'll be able to sell them for a profit. Many of those CDs are CDs that are marked promotional use only. All of the labels do this. They have these CDs that they give away to tastemakers, radio stations, journalists, people like that. They give away thousands of these CDs. Most of them don't actually have much downstream value because they're mostly identical to the stuff that's sold in stores. But my client, Mr. Augusto, picks out the ones that do have some lasting value because many of them are never actually released, or at least include tracks that are never released. So Troy has been doing this for a number of years. Universal Music Group has been sending takedown notices to eBay with respect to some of these CDs, not all of them, only some of them apparently offend Universal. And, you know, as is his right, my client has been sending DMCA counter notices saying this is bogus, these auctions are legit, this is legitimate merchandise. And ultimately, that led UMG to sue in Southern California in May. And I think they never expected that Mr. Augusto would put up a fight. I think their hope was they would just intimidate him out of the market. And instead, we got wind of it, and along with the San Francisco law firm of Pecker and Van Ness, we took up the case. So this goes to the first sale doctrine. Which is a doctrine that's actually a bit of a misnomer, but that traces its history in copyright law all the way back to 1908, which is in fact even before the sort of first modern copyright act in the U.S., which was in 1909. And in that case, there was a book publisher that sued Macy's, now famous department store, then New York retailer, who was basically buying this novel. It was entitled The Castaways, at wholesale, and then turning around and selling it in their stores for an amount that was less than the sort of manufacturer's suggested retail price, which was $1. Macy's thought they could drum up more business by selling it 89 cents, which is what they did. Well, they got sued by the publisher that claimed that because on the inside cover of the book, they had printed a notice that said this book not to be resold for less than $1, that they could sue Macy's for basically trying to sell for lower price. That case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1908. And the Supreme Court, in what was sort of the first famous copyright for sale case, said that once a copyright owner sells a book, they are not entitled to encumber it with post-sale restrictions, such as a mandatory minimum price. And that was then put into the Copyright Act in 1909, was again reaffirmed in the Copyright Act without any changes effectively in 1976. And so that really brings us to the present day, where most copyright owners have given up on the idea of putting these post-sale restrictions on their goods. Apparently, Universal never got the memo, and so they're now trying to do the same thing using the notices that they print on their goods, trying to reach out beyond the first sale.
Well, let's bring Professor Randy Picker into this and see what his thoughts are on this case and how first sale doctrine is unfolding here.
Sure. I thought what Fred said was fair, mainly. So I thought that was good. The only thing I guess I do want to say is it's fun to go back to the, you know, turn of the century. And so the Bob Merrill case, it is important to understand exactly what that case said. And that case was framed as a copyright case where Bob Merrill wanted to contend that the operative language of the copyright statute, the magic word then was vend, gave them control over these books through the Copyright Act. And as Fred said completely fairly, the court said, no, that doesn't work. What the case didn't address, very clear about the lines that it drew, what the case didn't address was whether Bob Merrill could do that through some sort of contractual approach. So Bob Merrill clearly doesn't address that issue. And then we have to ask the question to what extent the limitations that are stamped on these promo CDs sound, as we would put it, in contract. That's one issue. And then the second issue is even the current first sale doctrine doesn't tell us when ownership transfers. And the key thing for first sale to kick in is that there has to be a transfer of ownership. And the current statute just doesn't tell us how we can tell whether someone's rented the CD to you, lent the CD to you, bailed the CD to you, or has sold it to you, transferred ownership. Statute just doesn't say that, just doesn't address that. And so that's going to be a key issue in how this case plays out, which is how do we tell who actually owns one of these promo CDs?
Fred, how do you answer that?
Well, I actually agree with pretty much everything that Professor Picker has laid out. Let me try to answer some of those questions, or at least try to tell folks how it fits into our case. On the first issue, I agree completely that the first sale doctrine is about limiting the reach of the Copyright Act. It does not by itself tell us how contract law might apply. And there are some very interesting and potentially difficult cases, many of which are in the software context, that raise the question, what do you do when there is a contractual obligation to do or not do something? That, in my view, is not what's going on in this promo CD case. This is part of the reason why it's so important to keep these two things separate. If you are going to have a contract claim, you have to answer some very traditional contract law questions about privity, for example. In other words, if I have a contract with you, that doesn't mean that it binds all the people in the world who might, you know, obtain the goods from you later in the chain of commerce. So contractual rights of action have always been limited to sort of one degree of separation, unless you're able to come up with a sort of very specific story about how privity travels. So that's one limit to contract that makes it not nearly as potent a weapon as copyright law. The other important distinction is contract law doesn't give you nearly the kind of draconian remedies that copyright does. Copyright law entitles people to minimum statutory damages, even if the copyright owner is unable to prove that there's been any economic harm. They're also often entitled to injunctive relief on more lenient terms than a contract plaintiff would be. So while I agree with Professor Picker that whether there's a contract that binds a copy of goods is a separate question, I think you have to keep the distinctions in mind. And I think if copyright owners are resorting to copyright-type claims in these cases, it's precisely because they think they can get things with copyright law that contract law would traditionally not entitle them to. To turn just very briefly to the second question that Professor Picker raised, he's exactly right. When does ownership transfer is a critical question in first sale cases. Courts have already clearly said that first sale, and this is why I said it was a misnomer at the outset, first sale applies to gifts as well as to so-called sales. The courts have said if ownership passes, whether by sale, gift, legal action, what have you, the transfer of the ownership or something that's functionally like ownership is what triggers first sale. And again, in certain software contexts, there can be some very difficult questions to address about that. But in the case of promo CDs, in our view, the story couldn't be simpler. The record labels send out thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of these discs. To our knowledge, they've never collected them. In fact, when we ask industry insiders, have the record labels ever asked for these CDs to be returned, generally we're greeted with laughter. And then, of course, from my perspective, one of the more interesting evidentiary questions I intend to ask of UMG is, how do you treat these on your taxes? Because if these are leases or loans, then one would expect that they be depreciated over the lifetime of the good. And I'll bet you money right now that they expense in the first year. So I agree with Professor Picker. Ownership is important. I'm just quite confident we're going to win on that.
So what do you think that UMG's legal strategy will be if you were to speculate on that?
Well, it's interesting. This case, I think it was brought as purely an act of intimidation. I think they felt that they could, by bringing the suit, basically knock Roast Beast Music off of eBay. That's my suspicion. Of course, they've never told me. We have no evidence at this stage. But, guessing blind, that's why I think this lawsuit was brought. Now that we have shown up on the other side with capable co-counsel from one of the best law firms in San Francisco, I think Universal may be having second thoughts. At least that's my guess, based on the fact that they have just now substituted in a very prominent copyright lawyer in Los Angeles named Russ Frackman, who insiders will recognize as the same lawyer that they called in the Napster case, the Aimster case, the Rockster case, and in a host of flea market cases. So by all indications, Universal is taking this case perhaps a bit more seriously than they did at the outset.
Let me broaden the conversation just a bit here and also bring Brad and Cox into it. Brad, and some commenters have suggested that the ruling in this case could have implications for so-called shrink wrap licenses that are commonly attached to software products. Do you think a victory for the defendant in this case would make those end-user agreements harder to enforce in the software cases?
You know, actually, Adam, I think I see some differences here. But, let's just look at the big picture real quick. What we're talking about here, I think, is an artificial construct to solve a practical commercial problem. Despite the legal issues, and they're murky, and they get very in the weeds very quickly with this issue, I think. And it's certainly uncertain in some ways too. But there are good reasons to enforce these type of restrictions generally. Not even talking about this one in particular, but legitimate price differentiation reasons that creators of content will try to enforce somehow, whether it's music or even if it's software, or you'll see some discounted OEM copies that are labeled not for resale to avoid competing with the retail channel. And they'll do this for certain evaluation reasons or even giving it to nonprofits or schools. So in some ways it's about competition with the retail channel, not just copyright. I think with shrink wrap what we see is, we see a contract or a license that is hidden, and it's not even something that you can see before you even buy the product generally. There has to be some sort of further manifestation of assent, which is done generally when you go to install the product and a box comes up and it says, you have to read this, do you agree? And you have to actually actively click the box that you agree. And, here the restriction is in plain sight on the product in some ways, but it's also harder, though, to prove, I think, a manifestation of assent. And unless you can say that just by accepting it and playing it, you've already agreed to not resale it somehow.
So, Fred, before I get your response to what Braden said there, let me ask Professor Picker if he has any thoughts on the broader issues here for the license for computer software products and shrink wrap licenses.
Well, I actually thought what Fred said was fair, and I also thought what Braden said was fair, which is to say that we obviously are in a much more direct contractual setting in the software context than we typically are with regard to the promo CDs. So I think it'll be easier, as it were, to enforce the contractual approach to this situation. I think it is going to be harder, as Fred suggested, to go down the contractual path with regard to these promo CDs. So easier to do contracts for software, where we constantly face these EULAs, these end user license agreements that, as Braden said, we have to click through to get to the software. Harder to do that for the CDs.
Fred, what's your response to all that?
Well, actually, I want to step back even, you know, one step further here. While Braden is right that there are obviously some perfectly understandable commercial reasons to try to restrict post-sale uses, that doesn't mean that we should allow it as a matter of public policy. And perhaps, you know, more important, there are equally, I would argue, even more compelling public interest reasons that we should limit how those kinds of encumbrances basically clog up the channels of commerce. There are transaction costs to be considered. There are also sound public policy priorities. So let me give you a few high-level examples of why first sale is so vividly important and why we took this case.
Fred, can I, for a second, we want to distinguish use restrictions. You and I have had this conversation before offline. We want to distinguish these restrictions, which first sale doesn't get at, from transfer restrictions, which first sale does get at, yes?
Well, I think the two are closely entwined, and let me give you a few examples that I think will highlight that. Libraries, for example, are built completely on the first sale doctrine. The fact that libraries are able, after they purchase a book, to lend it for free to anyone they like is entirely grounded in the first sale doctrine. Same is true for used bookstores, for video rental stores. Today, many Hollywood studios enter agreements with certain rental services like Blockbuster, but many don't. And in fact, you have a vibrant market for rental in that area, thanks to the first sale doctrine. Similarly, you know, used record stores, used bookstores, the ability to give gifts, you know, to re-gift, as people say, in the holiday season. There's all kinds of reasons why the public has this right. And so to return to Professor Picker's point, I think use restrictions cannot be neatly separated, because I worry that if Universal is able to say promo use only, not for resale, what is to stop a book publisher from slipping a notice in that says, this book for personal use, not for library lending, or for, you know, movie studios to add logos to their discs that say, this for private home use only, not for rental. You know, there are all kinds of restrictions that, if one admits that they can be attached as a condition that flows with a copyright, I think you have a serious set of public policy concerns that are raised.
Yeah, I think you want to separate law and policy. So let's start with law. So I think that the first sale doctrine itself is crafted, is limited to these transfer restrictions, which is where the UMG case fits. I don't think it's crafted in the statute. We have to do law before we can do policy. It addresses these use restrictions. So I think it's going to take a change to the statute or a remarkably open reading of the statute to get the use restriction limitations into the first sale doctrine. I think as a policy matter, I think the issues are related. I think that's completely fair. And then that's an interesting discussion where Braden made obviously a number of points about the utility of market segmentation. And I think how you feel about that depends a lot on how competitive or uncompetitive you think these markets are. If you think they're relatively competitive, if you think they're great opportunities and increasing opportunities for people to distribute their works, then if it turns out that distributing your works free of these restrictions is a market-winning strategy, go to it. People who distribute subject to restrictions will then lose ground. And that's how the competitive landscape will play out. That's fine with me. I don't have a killer horse in this race.
Yeah, and I would just respond by saying I do have a horse in this race. And while I'm a big fan of the marketplace to address a vast array of concerns, traditionally limitations and exceptions to copyright law have stepped in where we have some reason to think that the marketplace alone will not adequately vindicate these concerns. And so, you know, as I often say to people, I don't need the fair use doctrine in order to protect popular speech, you know, any more than I need the First Amendment to protect popular speech. I need these exceptions precisely when you have things that are unpopular, or to use the market term, where the people whose interests are being protected do not have market power. So to take one vivid example, I'm quite certain that the publishers of the Harry Potter books, for example, could have freely put limitations into their books to stop libraries. I don't think libraries have enough purchasing power in the market to limit, or, you know, to be an effective punishment to publishers who would want to take that road for mass market titles. So there are some places where I think the limitations and exceptions rightfully step in. And the important difference here from real property law, I think, is copyright law is from its outset a public policy contingent property interest that is designed to vindicate social, goals. And so before we extend additional protections to rights holders, I think they have to make the case that we'll all be better off. And when I say we, I think most members of the public would include the interests of people like librarians and those who, you know, in the vibrancy of a secondary market and would like that to be protected. So, you know, I think it's an interesting question. I guess I would ask Professor Picker, I take it then on your view, cases like Bob's Merrill and the Adobe versus Softman case in software context, that the only reason First Sale steps in to eliminate those restrictions, those post-sale restrictions, would be because those restrictions run to further resale and redistribution. Is that right? I think I disagree.
I think Bob's Merrill is interesting in the sense that it comes from an era of cases where I think the Supreme Court was much more concerned about these use restrictions and these limitations on sale than I think we are now. So Bob's Merrill was decided relatively contemporaneously with a parallel antitrust case on this kind of pricing. That would be the Dr. Miles case. The Supreme Court recently overturned Dr. Miles in the Legion case in the last term, basically saying that the inalienability concerns, there's a hard word to say, the inalienability concerns that sort of dominated the early 1900s just don't seem to carry as much weight in the marketplace today.
So if I understand correctly, then it's your view that a book publisher could slip on the inside cover a notice that says personal reading use only. Oh, well, wait, I guess that actually would run into it because that's a redistribution limitation. Let me see if I've got a better example. How about on a DVD, a restriction that says for home use only, not for public performance in any venue?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly the kind of market separation that we should think is contemplated by the copyright statute. The copyright statute itself reflects different kinds of uses and offers different protections for those. So obviously, the public performance right is very different than the distribution right, and it's precisely because the copyright statute understands that there are often different markets associated with those, and the copyright statute protects the copyright owner largely in those situations.
I agree with you to that extent, but I guess I'm wondering, what if I were to go ahead and get a public performance license? Would I be restrained by this kind of a notice from using a DVD in order to exercise my rights under that license? In other words, I'm trying to figure out whether or not rights holders can impose these kinds of post-sale restrictions to try to separate markets based on use rather than on alienability.
But understand that situation, because now this is a situation where you've gone to the original rights holder and gotten a performance right, and then the only question is, what is your means of actually accessing to work to implement your performance right? Right, and the question then is whether the performance right holder has the means of giving that to you, and that's something presumably the performance right holder is going to worry about and try to solve on his or her own.
The one exception, though, where this has already occurred is where you have, for example, a license that's granted by a compulsory license, for example, or some other functioning like that, where perhaps the interest of the person who controls the physical object is not identical with the interest of the person who is licensing separate rights. So this has come up, for example, in the webcasting context, where webcasters went to the Copyright Office and said, we have a right to broadcast music under the licenses granted to us by the Copyright Act. But when rights holders use digital rights management restrictions on music downloads or other copy-protected CDs, for example, we are unable to access the work in order to exercise the rights we have. And so
but
I'm just wondering whether
you solve compulsory license, right?
Okay,
I mean,
well,
that's to say that they – yeah. So that it seems to me the compulsory license is the right form for doing that.
Right, and it would presumably then you'd say you'd have to – expressly override any terms. Yeah. Okay,
yes.
Well, that's an interesting refinement. I'd have to think more about that. But it is true that so far the cases where this has come up are like Bob's Merrill and the Adobe case that I mentioned, where a software vendor was acquiring bundled Adobe software, unbundling it, and then selling off the pieces as separate products, as well as the library cases I mentioned. All of those are cases where the restriction would be a restriction on further lending or further distribution. And I think Professor Picker and I agree that the first sale doctrine, if it does nothing else, it puts a bar against that.
But I wonder, you know, if we expand the use to apply into the first sale doctrine, and what does that mean to a lot of the copyright licenses that we see in the open source world, where we see a lot of restrictions on use after sale or and upon ownership, particularly with the GPL. It seems like, and you know, to get back to Professor Picker's point, where we see a lot of competition, we see a lot of enablement of copyright holders, maybe we should encourage these kind of activities that allow content creators to place various restrictions, whether they're ideological or business-oriented.
That's a very interesting point.
Well, but wait a minute. The GPL, I don't think the GPL does restrict the use of the material. The GPL primarily restricts distribution. I think that
which is the heartland of the first sale doctrine, though, right?
Right. I mean, if you download a piece of software and are simply using it in your own private, in your home or in your private business, I don't think the GPL says anything about what you can or cannot do with that software. It's only when you become a redistributor of the GPL that you then have to agree to the terms of the GPL.
When you say a redistributor, I mean, obviously one of the most principal uses you might make of GPL software is to make other software. And the precise point of the GPL restriction, obviously, is to limit the kind of software that you can create using it. And I want to say whether you can do that on a for-profit model or free of the GPL going forward.
Well, let me actually invoke Professor Picker's very smart observation that we should start with the law and then go to policy. With respect to the law, I think the GPL really doesn't run afoul of the first sale doctrine in any meaningful way, because when you're talking about software generally, and certainly in the GPL context, you're really talking about a reproduction right that is being exercised, not a distribution right. And so, as many people have argued, the first sale doctrine only limits the distribution right. It does not end up limiting other rights, including the reproduction right and the right to make derivative works. So I don't think there's any direct clash between the GPL and the first sale doctrine. Now, whether as a policy matter the GPL should be able to restrict those kinds of activities, you know, that's an interesting question. I happen to think that, the GPL, because it operates as a permission, because it entitles you to do things under copyright law that you otherwise wouldn't be entitled to do, I don't really read it as a restriction. I don't read it as an effort to prohibit things you would otherwise be entitled to do. But I will admit that there probably is room to have a debate around it.
Yeah, and that's what UMG would presumably say about the promo CDs, to circle back. They would say you don't have an entitlement to get CDs from us. We're giving you something you don't have a right to, and all we're doing is limiting in some ways that which we're giving you.
Right, but the key difference there is that they are giving you the physical good. In other words, when I go into a record store and I buy a CD, or when I go into a bookstore and I buy a book, I am not acquiring a license. I'm acquiring the physical object, and I'm entitled to do anything with that physical object I like, as long as it doesn't intrude on the exclusive rights that are reserved to the copyright owner. So when I go, you know, in the case of Mr. Augusto, when he goes to a used record store and buys a CD and takes it home, he is not acquiring a license of any kind. He's acquiring the good. And the Copyright Act specifically says that the distribution right, which is the only right that is even, I think, arguably implicated by his sale, is at an end. Once it has crossed that first veil of ownership, the distribution right no longer applies. So that's, you know, I think that's the distinction here. It might be very different if it was something where he was making copies of the CD.
Yeah, though I think we're back to the question of when does ownership transfer. But
yes, and I think that raises a lot of very thorny and interesting questions in a lot of contexts, just not in the context of this case.
Well, Fred, where does this case go next? What's the timetable for this?
Well, the complaint was filed in May. We filed an answer and a counterclaim just this month, and we are waiting for UMG's response, which we expect to have probably sometime in September. And then we'll see what happens then. I expect there will be some discovery. As I said, I have some questions for the tax preparers at Universal. I may have some additional questions for, you know, the people who mail these thousands of CDs out about whether they keep track of who they mail them to, as you might imagine you would if it were really a loan. You know, and then we'll see what happens. I expect this case to be resolved, at least in the universe of federal lawsuits, relatively quickly. But that, of course, you know, in the world of federal lawsuits, that could take a year or two, and we would still call that quick. So that's, I think, where we currently stand in this case. One interesting thing I should point out, we have brought a counterclaim against Universal, which is to say we have affirmatively sued them for sending the DMCA takedown notices at eBay in the first place. It's our view that any copyright lawyer would immediately have known that an effort to take down these CDs runs afoul of the first sale doctrine. And just like we were able to prevail in an earlier case against Diebold when it tried to censor some critical information about its voting machines off the Internet, we believe the judge will find that no reasonable lawyer, no reasonable person in UMG's position could believe that those takedown notices were proper. And so there is that claim as well, which arises under a relatively unknown portion of the DMCA that allows people to sue for bogus takedowns. There's an interesting case that is finding its way into the Supreme Court this coming term that touches on many of these same issues in the patent context. So I just wanted to make sure your listeners who are interested in this issue knew about that. It's a case named Quanta versus LG Electronics. It looks like it's actually going to be accepted by the Supreme Court because the U.S. Solicitor General actually has invited the court to take it. That involves patent exhaustion, which is the sort of first sale doctrine of patent law. And in that case, LG, which is a big electronics company, purchased a portfolio of patents, which they then licensed to Intel. Intel was given the right to make, use, and sell products that incorporated these patents. But they were also required to send to their customers a notice that said, by buying these materials, these chipsets from us, you do not get any patent rights from LG. And so now LG is saying, we get to go after every customer of Intel's and force them to take a separate license. In other words, we get to continue going after people, notwithstanding the first sale by Intel, which was, as I said, an authorized seller. So I think this could be very interesting and touches on many similar questions about can you, under patent law, sort of have restrictions run down the chain of commerce. Monsanto, for example, has put restrictions like this on some of its patented seeds, and Lexmark has put restrictions like this onto its printer cartridges, forbidding users from refilling those cartridges. So first sale has a vibrant life well beyond the world of copyright.
Very interesting, and it sounds like another good topic for another TLF podcast. We'll have to have you guys on again to discuss that one, Fred. Well, that's going to do it for Tech Policy Weekly this week. I want to thank Fred von Lohmann, Professor Randy Picker, Braden Cox, and Tim Lee for joining me this week. And to read more commentary from the entire Technology Liberation Front gang, visit us at techliberation.com. Also, if you'd like to comment about something we said here on today's show, you can post a comment on the website. Just go to techliberation.com/podcast, and you can leave a comment on the page of the show. If you like what you heard, please tell a friend. Please write a review of the show on iTunes, and don't forget to dig our podcast. Until next week, I'm Adam Thier. See you then.